Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 15, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Bronx Household case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. As is our habit, we'll hear brief opening remarks from each speaker, about 5 to 10 minutes each, followed by an exchange between our speakers, followed by your questions, so please be preparing your questions as we go along. First up will be Jordan Lawrence, Senior Counsel and Senior Vice President with Alliance for Defending Freedom, at its Washington, D.C. office. Mr. Lawrence has litigated many First Amendment cases around the nation since 1984. We'll then hear from Professor Alan Brownstein of UC Davis Law School, where his scholarship includes but is not limited to church-state issues and free exercise in Establishment Clause doctrine. Extensive bios for each speaker are available on our website and were provided to you in the notice of today's call, so let's get right to the discussion. And with that, Mr. Lawrence, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, and I appreciate the Federalist Society for sponsoring this debate, the telephonic debate. New York City public schools have a policy that allow their 1,200 buildings to be used by individuals and community groups for anything pertaining to the welfare of the community, is how their policy reads. But they have a specific policy that prohibits their use for religious services or religious instruction or for using the facilities as a house of worship. Of the 50 largest school districts in the country, New York City is number one, of course, in terms of student population, and it is the only school district that has a policy like this. If you go to Chicago or Los Angeles or other large school districts, renting for worship services is routine and happens and is permitted by policy. The Bronx Household of Faith is a small evangelical church that started back in 1973. It was meeting in houses in a poor neighborhood, the Bronx, in the University Heights area. And around 1995, they decided that they were too big for the facility, and there were two schools in their neighborhood, and they asked if they could meet there for their Sunday morning worship services, and the school district said no, and we invoking this policy. The Alliance Defending Freedom and me started this lawsuit back in 1995, and it has been going on basically ever since. And rather than give you the long, torturous procedural posture of this, I'll just put it this way. In 2001, we got a permanent injunction against the school district's policy that basically was in effect for 10 years. It took the Second Circuit a long time to come down with a final ruling, which they did in 2011, and by a 2-to-1 vote said that this policy was okay. It did not violate the free speech rights of the church. We appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court turned us down in December of 2011. Then we went back into court about a year ago saying our free exercise clause rights and our establishment clause rights are also violated by this policy. And Chief Judge Loretta Preska of the Southern District of New York granted a new injunction approximately a year ago saying that these provisions were also violated. And in essence, what she said was something like this. The free exercise clause is violated because the policy, as interpreted by the Second Circuit, allows, and I want to read the language here, although it bans worship services, it allows prayer, religious instruction, expressions of devotion to God, and the singing of hymns, whether done by a person or a group, that those do not constitute worship. And their definition of a worship service is prohibited is the conduct of a particular type of event, a collective activity characteristically done according to an order prescribed and under the auspices of organized religion, typically but not necessarily conducted by an ordained official of the religion. So in other words, if there's sort of a traditional worship service that you would think of, maybe a Catholic Mass or a Jewish synagogue service, Episcopal service, those would be banned. But as we began to get into the evidence, and we pointed out that this was the free exercise violation, that if you're more free form, like a Pentecostal church, those were permitted. If you were a Quakers, which have basically a totally free form worship style, they were permitted. In fact, we were finding that non-theistic religious groups that were essentially Eastern religions, some forms of Buddhism and Hinduism, do not have, they don't call their meetings, their religious rituals, worship, because they don't worship a deity. We pointed all of this out, as well as the fact that the school district allowed many, many student-led religious meetings during the school day when students were there to engage in essentially all these practices. And so that if their goal was to not give the wrong impression that the schools were endorsing religion, they were straining the gnat and swallowing the camel by allowing all these other religious events and expression and rituals to occur, and just basically eliminating these other ones. We've had oral arguments before the Second Circuit for the fifth time on November 19th, and we are awaiting a decision on that. Now, the school district, their justification for this policy is basically concerns about the Establishment Clause. And the Second Circuit, in their opinion back in 2011, took great pains to say that there was not a proven violation of the Establishment Clause, but that there were concerns about it. And they have a number of things, and I'm just going to quickly touch on two of them. That is, that the churches dominate the forum when they use them, and that also this is a government subsidy of religion. Both of those the district court rejected, and I think that those are wrong. Now, the domination of the forum is something like this, that the churches, when they rent a school for, say, 3 or 4 hours on a Sunday morning, they rent the auditorium and several classrooms, and they occupy a lot of space, and that this is dominating the forum. Now, the forum, by our definition, is all 1,200 school buildings, and we're probably talking on a Sunday morning of, at the height, no more than about 80 to 90 churches in 1,200 school buildings. And it's kind of like complaining that there's domination of a Starbucks in Midtown Manhattan. If one's too full, you just walk, you know, a block down the street to another one. And in this school, in fact, I walked it in this area. There's the schools are 3 blocks apart from each other. But we also showed examples of where there were simultaneous uses. One school in Brooklyn had a church meeting, a farmer's market, and a basketball league that all took place at the same time. So that we don't believe that there really is domination of the forum, that there's plenty of empty buildings that are there, and that even if there are, it should be allocated on some basis that's not content-based on religion. The subsidy argument goes something like this, that because there's obviously no money from the government going to the churches. The only money changing hands is from the churches or other groups paying under a uniform schedule of, you know, depending on how much space you rent and for how long, that determines how much you pay. But the argument is something like this. If Bronx Household of Faith were to rent, you know, the Javits Center or the ballroom at the Ritz-Carlton for their church services or the Trump Towers, it would cost $1 zillion. And the renting the school is a lot cheaper. So that difference is an in-kind contribution. And I think that that is wrong because the school district sets the rates. And the Supreme Court has rejected that kind of an argument that generally available services are somehow subsidies to a religious group. It would be kind of like saying that if a synagogue hooks up to the city sewer system, that's a subsidy to religion because the synagogue saved all this money by not having to set up its own sewer system. And so I think that that is just wrong. Even if it doesn't cover all the costs of the city sets the rates. They're the ones in total control of the rates that are set. They allow long-term use. They allow weekly meetings. The churches are simply asking in this case for it to be able to use the facilities on the same terms and conditions as all other groups. So now I will turn it over to Professor Brownstein.
Thanks, Jordan. And I want to thank David Ray and the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in today's program. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about the free exercise issue and then go on to discuss the free speech issues in the case. First, I know this is supposed to be a debate, but I agree with Jordan. I think the board's revised regulation violates the free exercise clause. There's no permit shall be granted for the purpose of holding religious worship services or otherwise using a school as a house of worship. That's a regulation that's directed at religion. Therefore, it has to be justified under strict scrutiny review. Now, as Jordan mentioned, the board argued that its regulation furthers the compelling state interest of avoiding a violation of the Establishment Clause. Now, I think the board is correct in the sense that there are potential Establishment Clause violations in the circumstances of this case. That is, I think there's a strong argument that it violates the Establishment Clause for a state to allow a religious congregation to use a public facility as a permanent house of worship. Public buildings shouldn't become churches or synagogues or mosques on a permanent basis. And one Establishment Clause concern is the perception of endorsement that's created by the very long-term use of a public building as a church by a specific congregation. The other problem is the size of the subsidy provided for in this kind of an arrangement. And here, Jordan's much more familiar with the facts than I am. It's unclear as to the exact size of the subsidy. But speaking generally, I think that acquiring land, constructing a house of worship, maintaining the building and grounds, arranging for insurance utilities, these are some of the most substantial costs a religious congregation confronts in operating a house of worship. And basically, I don't think government should be in the business of relieving churches of these costs, and churches shouldn't rely on government for this level of support. Governments that own churches control churches. Congregations that depend on government for the existence of the sanctuary in which they worship simply depend on government too much. I think the Establishment Clause limits the risks created by government substantially supporting a church in this way. So it may be that the board is attempting to further a compelling state interest in this case. But the problem, from my perspective, is that there are far less restrictive regulatory alternatives available to the board that would further this goal than banning all religious worship from school facilities. I don't see how an occasional use of public school facilities for worship services violates the Establishment Clause. And I doubt that the interim use of public school facilities for worship services by a growing congregation would violate the Establishment Clause either. There are time, place, and manner regulations the board could adopt to limit the permanent, allegedly dominant use of school facilities by outside groups. That would avoid all of the board's Establishment Clause concerns. Banning all religious worship from school facilities simply isn't necessary to further the board's arguably compelling state interests. But now I want to turn to the free speech issues in this case, because to some extent I think they're more interesting and important issues. Because over most of the 15 years that this dispute has been going on, it's been litigated as a free speech case. And the primary free speech issue was a fairly technical one, whether a regulation excluding religious worship services from a limited public forum constituted viewpoint discrimination, which gets a very rigorous standard of review, or content discrimination, which is reviewed under a much more lenient reasonableness standard. The court ultimately concluded that the regulation in this case was content discriminatory. Now, I want to suggest a different, perhaps radically different way of thinking about this case. I think the important question to ask isn't whether the board's regulation should be characterized as viewpoint discriminatory or content discriminatory. It's whether the board's regulation should be characterized as restricting speech at all, as opposed to characterizing it as burdening the free exercise of religion. It's a question of fact. I think worship services are both speech and the exercise of religion. as a question of constitutional law. The question is, how should we characterize religious expressive activities that are subject to overlapping doctrinal frameworks, freedom of speech and the free exercise of religion? And for conceptual as well as doctrinal reasons, I think we're much better off characterizing many religious expressive activities as the exercise of religion. We're much better off challenging laws that burden these activities as violations of the Free Exercise Clause rather than the Free Speech Clause. I think that because if we conceptualize religion under the religion clauses, we recognize that there's something distinctive about religion that justifies the government treating religious individuals and institutions differently than the way it treats similarly situated non-religious individuals and institutions. The Free Exercise Clause is predicated on this foundation, the idea that there's something special about religion. If we conceptualize religion as a subject or a viewpoint of speech, we see religion from a very different perspective. For Free Speech Clause purposes, no subject or viewpoint of speech is special. No subject or viewpoint of speech deserves to be treated differently than any other subject or viewpoint of speech. Religious individuals and institutions are simply one group of speakers among many in a competitive marketplace of ideas. And the government has no business using its regulatory power to favor any speaker or message over another. So I think that characterizing religion as speech undercuts the principle that there's something distinctive about religion for constitutional purposes. From a doctrinal perspective, I think the problem is even more serious. The displacement of the Free Exercise Clause by the Free Speech Clause for adjudicating claims involving religious expressive activity may severely undercut the legitimacy of laws accommodating religious liberty, or shielding it from state interference. If we understand religion as a liberty right, the exercise of religion receives distinctive protection and accommodations that don't have to be provided to secular activities or institutions. Now, after Employment Division versus Smith, religion-specific accommodations are rarely constitutionally mandated, but they're often constitutionally permissible. Put simply, the religion clauses don't prohibit the distinctive treatment of religion by the state. If anything, they acknowledge the propriety of distinctive treatment in limiting the state's ability to interfere with or promote religion. Free speech doctrine, on the other hand, is entirely different. If we conceptualize religious expressive activities as speech, indeed as a viewpoint of speech, then free speech principles prohibit government from treating these religious activities any differently than non-religious expressive activities. The same principle that prohibits government from discriminating against religion operates with equal force to prohibit government from discriminating in favor of religion through religion-specific accommodations and protections. I think the implications of this conclusion are pretty far-reaching. We go back to Bronx Household of Faith case. The board's regulation that I read to you discriminates against religious worship and the activities of a house of worship. If that regulation violates the Free Speech Clause because it constitutes impermissible viewpoint discrimination, then regulations that discriminate in favor of religious worship and the activities of a house of worship also constitute viewpoint discrimination. They should be struck down as unconstitutional. Think about what that means. Think about how it might apply to a law such as RLUIPA, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, that provides special protection to religious land uses in the land use regulatory process, and those religious land uses are often houses of worship. Does RLUIPA impermissibly discriminate in favor of religion in violation of Free Speech Clause? Might a challenger to RLUIPA argue that it unconstitutionally privileges religious assemblies, messages, viewpoints, in the marketplace of ideas? I think there are a lot of other examples I could give you. basically, I worry that we're undermining our cultural commitment to the idea that there's something distinctive about religion, and we're jeopardizing the constitutionality of discretionary religious accommodations when we characterize religion as speech for constitutional purposes, rather than characterizing religion as, well, religion. And this is a price we don't have to pay. Jordan and I agree. The regulation in Bronx Household of Faith violates the Free Exercise Clause. There's no need to use free speech doctrine to challenge a regulation that discriminates against religion. Free Exercise Clause can do that job, and it can do it without any of the risks associated with using the Free Speech Clause in its place. Thank you. I hope I didn't go too long.
Thank you, Professor. If you've just joined us, or if you joined us late, we're speaking today with Jordan Lawrence and Professor Alan Brownstein about the Bronx Household case in the Second Circuit. I do want to open the floor to questions. In a moment, everyone will hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our phone lines are open. And while we're waiting, Professor Brownstein, you said quite a bit. Let me give Jordan Lawrence a minute or two to add to his opening remarks and respond, and then we'll go back to Professor, and then we'll come back to the audience.
Jordan more than a minute or two if he needs it.
Well, I want to say that I think it's very intriguing what Professor Brownstein had to say. And the only thing that I would characterize as anything as a disagreement or anything like that, I want to say up front and then comment on his kind of big picture doctrinal thing, which I think is very interesting, is that I don't think factually the nature of what churches do and why they're renting the school buildings, that they want to stay as like long-term users of the school facilities. Now we've because this case has gone on so long, there were 23 churches that were meeting. I mean, this is just one of the facts we got in the record, that were meeting in 2004, and there were about 80 to 90. Now the number has increased in the 2010-2011 school year, but only four of the churches that were meeting in 2004 were still meeting in 2010-2011. The churches do want to get into their own facilities. It is a big hassle to put up equipment, sound equipment, for example, or bring in stuff for a Sunday school and then take it all down and store it somewhere. They have to rent everything in advance. If they have some other meeting that's out of their ordinary schedule, they can't really hold it at the school at the last minute. So this is definitely a transitional facility till they can raise enough money to build their own facilities. In fact, Bronx Household of Faith is doing that. Now, getting to the doctrinal issue, which I think is really an interesting question, is that the reason why these cases have been predominantly treated as freedom of speech cases is because of a case called Widmar v. Vincent that the Supreme Court decided back in 1981, where some litigants at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, a college Christian group was kicked off campus for similar reasons that New York City is doing here in this case. And the Supreme Court basically said, we're going to view these predominantly as freedom of speech cases. And they've had a number of other cases, Rosenberger, Lamb's Chapel, Good News Club, where they've used that paradigm. And we brought in free exercise simply because we had cert denied on our free speech claim, and we just looked at our complaint and said, what do we have left in the bag to put back into court? And it was much more of a kind of an ad hoc tactical decision, as opposed to what you heard from Professor Brownstein was more of an analytical, thought through reason that, you know, these cases are better as free exercise clauses cases rather than free speech cases. And I have to admit that in sort of the rush of litigation, I've never asked the question to myself, okay, if we had this to do all over again and had a blank sheet of paper, would we say free exercise or free speech or both? And I think Professor Brownstein brings up some very excellent points that maybe these should be done viewed as predominantly free exercise rather than freedom of speech. Now, the one thing that I would add to this is that what we find in a number of religious liberty cases is that there is not a expressive action to it. So, for example, like these HHS mandate cases, I don't think could be viewed as expression cases or freedom of speech cases. They're just pure free exercise, Religious Freedom Restoration Act cases. Bronx, there's the overlap, as Professor Brownstein talked about, and I'm not sure that makes a big difference, but many religious liberty cases can be characterized as speech cases, but not all religious liberty cases are necessarily speech cases. You know, it's like it works one way, but not necessarily the other way. So, I'm not sure I know what I think about that as to whether we should just abandon free speech as the way to look at these. But I think that he raises some excellent points.
This is Professor Brownstein. If these are interim uses of public school facilities by churches, I don't think there's any Establishment Clause violation at all. I used to live in New York City, you can tell by my accent, but I live in a small college town now. And what basically happens is you get a few people of a religious denomination who move into the town, they start holding worship services in their homes. Pretty soon they have too many congregants to meet in their homes, and the zoning regulations prohibit them from continuing to use their homes as a worship site. And they don't have the resources to develop land and construct a house of worship, and they have to go somewhere, and public facilities are available. And I don't think it violates the Establishment Clause for cities that make these public facilities available to everybody else to allow churches to use them on an interim basis until they grow large enough and can acquire the resources they need in order to actually move into their own home, to their own house of worship. And if there was some concern that some church or other, some synagogue or mosque, would try to stay forever, as I mentioned, there are time, place, and manner rules that could prevent that from happening. And I agree that not all free exercise claims involve speech, but an awful lot of religion is expressive in nature. Sermons from the pulpit, prayer, proselytizing. So an awful lot of the cases involving discrimination against religion involve discrimination against religion that, at least in part, is expressive in nature. When we open it to a Q&A.
Very good. Again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like we have one caller question at this point, and then our lines will be open. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that there is a perennial problem in that we lack a definition of religion that can distinguish it from non-religion in these discussions to bring in the Establishment Clause. My organization, the Constitution Society, is also known as a constitutionalist church. Our religion is constitutionalism. So we, of course, raise the question, basing our position on the court decision that secular humanism is a religion, and our religion is similar to secular humanism in that regard, that we may need to make an exception for constitutionalism in the Establishment Clause, because otherwise we can't teach devotion to our own constitution in a public school. So what do you think about that concept in the mix?
Was this directed at one of us in particular?
Both of you.
Well, I agree. First, go ahead, Jordan. You want to talk?
Well, I'll just say that this whether there should be a definition of religion or not in the Constitution. Here, I've litigated these kind of cases for many years, and I'm not sure exactly what I think about it. I do think, though, that the type of Establishment Clause issue you raise is this is just my personal opinion on this from the cases that I've litigated, that I think that unless you have some sort of formal governmental coercion in the issue in the matter, forcing people to pay money, forcing people to say something, that sort of thing, I don't think it's an establishment of religion. And if you're talking about basically a promotion of values and saying the Constitution is valuable, if somebody objects to that, I think they have a right to opt out of that. But I think that it would be basically you can't teach anything in a public school because it would all be establishment of religion. And I just think that the concept then begins to break down of having any political value at that point.
Yeah, I would just add that as far as I know, no one has successfully come up with a good working operational definition of religion. There are some court cases that attempt to come up with a definition. Some, I think, are better than others. This isn't only a problem for the United States. European countries, countries around the world that have working democracies and try to protect religious liberty confront the problem of what exactly is it that we're trying to protect and how do we identify it. I don't think I've read any opinions that are fully persuasive in answering that question. With regard to the Establishment Clause concern, I think generally if there are strong secular reasons for making something part of the curriculum, for example, mathematics, the fact that someone worships math would not make it a violation of the Establishment Clause to teach math. On the other hand, if you teach scripture in a devotional format, you're essentially asking people to pray with you to God, there is no secular explanation for why you're doing that. That is essentially theological, and I think that violates the Establishment Clause.
We have one more caller question at this point, and then our lines will be open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our next caller, bear with me as I give you news of our upcoming calls next week. We've got a very complete schedule next week. On Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number, we will host a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. George Mason Professor Adam Mossoff and Mr. Doug Nelson will be attending oral argument in the Bowman versus Monsanto Supreme Court case and reporting to us on how the argument went. That's Tuesday at 2. On Wednesday at 2, we'll take a broader look at the recess appointments issue in the wake of the Noel Canning case and the implications of that decision and what it might mean for other recess appointments. On Thursday at 12 noon Eastern Time, our call will be about national security and intelligence leaks. And then on Friday at 2, we'll be talking about federal criminal prosecutions. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Jeff Schaefer with Blackstone Legal Fellowship. Professor Brownstein, I share Jordan's interest in your proposal and with respect specifically to your observation that if exclusion of religious speech would be viewpoint discrimination, similarly, would privileging it be a viewpoint discriminatory problem under standard speech clause analysis? And I'm wondering, does the free exercise clause itself perhaps create an exception to what your otherwise impeccable logic would require? That is to say, it certainly would be the true truth that if union labor speech were to be treated favorably or negatively, we would find viewpoint discrimination. But because there is a free exercise clause, that may allow for a particular kind of privileging of this sort of speech. I wonder what your thoughts would be on that.
Well, I do think there are circumstances where we could privilege expressive activity to the rubric of the free exercise clause. What I think we need to do, and I'm not saying this is an easy task to perform, I think we have to create demarcation lines that would enable courts and everyone else to determine when a particular case is properly adjudicated as a free exercise case and when it might be more properly adjudicated under the free speech clause. I mean, I'll give you an example. It's a case, Texas Monthly versus Bullock, which dealt with sales taxes and use taxes, and it gave an exemption from those taxes for religious publications. The law was struck down under the Establishment Clause, but I think it was Justice White wrote an opinion just for himself, which said, you know, we really ought to evaluate this case under the Free Speech Clause, because what we're talking about is books and periodicals, and if you're discriminating between the content of one book or periodical as opposed to another, that's really more of a free speech case. I don't think that's a bad argument. On the other hand, if we're talking about a sermon offered by a minister, a rabbi, an imam, during worship services, I have no doubt that that's expression and that it's part of the marketplace of ideas. But given where it occurs, when it occurs, and the context in which it occurs, I think that should be viewed as the exercise of religion. And therefore, we ought to be able to accommodate and treat differently that speech, that kind of religious expressive activity, than non-religious expressive activity in other institutional contexts. So rather than saying free exercise clause is a special rule for free speech clause purposes, I think we'd be better off saying there are certain kinds of cases that should be viewed as free exercise cases and others as free speech cases.
Jordan Lawrence, did you have anything on this point?
No, I think that's fine.
Okay. Well, we have another caller question here. We have one question in the queue. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi. Yes, I had a question on the Establishment Clause discussion that's going on. I don't know how familiar you guys are with the current Obamacare, ACA, PPACA cases that are out there, but there's one that was just sent back to the Fourth Circuit, the Liberty case, and there was an argument in their brief from the district court that having certain exemptions for, you know, a few different exemptions that were in the law for healthcare sharing ministries, for several different exemptions, saying that that was an establishment of religion on the basis that it's favoring one something over another, whether that be, you know, secular entity or whether that be anything. I was just wondering your thoughts on the viability of that argument. Is that really an establishment when it's, you know, entity, not necessarily, I know we're struggling with defining religion, but I'm just wondering your thoughts on that type of establishment clause.
I think that I am not totally familiar with that, but this is the one thing I can bring to the table on this, is that if there is a law under the Employment Division v. Smith and the Church of the Babalui, Lukumi Babalui case, if there is a law that says basically we don't give a religious exemption, but we give an exemption to somebody else for a different reason. And so, for example, I remember when Justice Alito was on the Third Circuit, he had a case where a police department said no police officer can wear beards unless you have a health condition. And many African Americans have a condition where they get a lot of ingrown hairs, and if they grow a beard, they can do that.
And he basically ruled because there is a medical exemption so that police officers can have beards, you can't deny it for religious purposes. And I think that that may be the kind of argument that Liberty University is making, that there are some exemptions that the law grants, and so that probably either under the Free Exercise Clause or the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the government can't has to extend the exemption also to those with religious-based objections.
Yeah, I mean, this is Alan Brownstein. I'm not familiar with the litigation you're describing at all, so I can't comment on it. But I do think Jordan raises a very interesting issue as to which there isn't a clear answer yet. And that is, we do know from Lukumai that if you grant enough exemptions to secular interests, but you refuse to grant an exemption for a religious claimant, the court can characterize that as a religious gerrymander and strike it down and say, look, you're pretending these are neutral laws of general applicability, but really it's riddled with so many exceptions for non-religious interests that your refusal to grant an exemption for a religious claim is discriminatory. What we really don't know the answer to is how many exemptions for secular interests there has to be before you conclude that you're violating the rules set out in Lukumai. The Fraternal Order of Police case that Jordan mentioned basically says if there's one exception for a secular interest and you deny a religious claimant, that violates the Free Exercise Clause. I'm not sure the Supreme Court would accept that because I think it would undermine Smith substantially. Now, I'm no fan of the Smith decision. I think it was wrongly decided. But I don't know that the court would allow Smith to be undermined but not overruled by this idea that as long as there's one exception for a secular interest and you deny a religious claimant an exemption, that requires strict scrutiny review. Because there are exemptions to an enormous number of laws. So I think this would really fundamentally undermine the Smith decision. The other issue that bothers me about this argument that if you grant a secular exemption, you have to grant a religious exemption as well, is that it makes free exercise rights essentially a fortuity, depending on whether the government has created a secular exemption for particular laws. And you can have situations where the same free exercise right is vindicated in one institutional context, let's say a police department, but not another, depending on the fortuity of one police department granting a secular exemption and the other not granting a secular exemption. So I would like to see Smith overruled. I'd like to see more rigorous free exercise protection provided to individuals and institutions, but I'm not sure that the exemption analysis for Fraternal Order of Police really does the job.
This is Jordan Lawrence. If I can just add one other thing, too, which I think is just sort of an interesting distinction to be made, is that if you compare like the Fraternal Order of Police case or the Obamacare case with Bronx Household of Faith, is that most free exercise cases, I think, are more like the police case in Obamacare, where there's sort of a general law, there may be a few exemptions, and then somebody has a religious exemption. And the law doesn't really talk about religion one way or the other with this. And that's where a lot of these cases come out. I think it's a bit unusual and somewhat easier in a free exercise context to challenge a policy like New York City's, where they say everybody can use the facilities except for worship services. And so there's a specific carve out of the worship services, and to challenge that under the Free Exercise Clause to me just seems a more of a direct conflict with the constitutional provision rather than kind of these indirect cases. And that's why Scalia threw up his hands and say, You know, you can't get an exemption if it's a general law, a neutral law of general applicability. And I think the New York City policy is clearly not that.
Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open at this moment. And let me ask a question, maybe directed to Jordan Lawrence. Jordan, in your opening remarks, you mentioned this policy is unique within the nation. I understood you to say that. And also, the case began 17 years ago. I'm wondering what the level of awareness of the citizenry of the city is with regard to the specifics of this case, whether there's been any move to try and change the policy during the pendency of the case, and who's paying for the litigation on behalf of the city.
It's the city taxpayers that are paying it. The city corporate counsel's office is defending it. I would say up until about a year ago, nobody was really aware that this case existed because of all these procedural court machinations. There was basically 10 years of an injunction, and New York City was functioning of allowing basically everybody to use their facilities. And so when the Supreme Court denied review in December of 2011, so just about like 14 months ago, then all of a sudden there was 80, 90 churches that were about to get thrown out. There were many members on the city council said, what? We have a policy like this. And in fact, one of the things that was somewhat interesting, there's a councilman from the Bronx named Fernando Cabrera, who is also a pastor of a Pentecostal church. And he called up to to rent a school, and they said, well, we just had the Supreme Court deny review in this case, so we're not going to rent to you for your Sunday morning services. And he's been sort of leading the charge against Mayor Bloomberg's policy. In New York City, the city school system is not a separate political entity like it is in some communities, but is a department of the city government. And Mayor Bloomberg has been very adamant that, no big sodas, no styrofoam, no guns, no worship services in the public schools. Now, that was a little humor there. And there's been an effort to change it in the legislature. It passed the New York Senate. And in fact, there was a majority of the assembly members that had signed on to it, but the Speaker of the House, the Speaker of the Assembly, would not allow the bill to come to the floor. So that was, in fact, one of the reasons why we went back into court, because things were being stymied at both the city council level and at the state legislature level to change this policy.
Okay. And finally, where does this case end? When do you see it ending? How will it end?
Well, I think we may be getting closer to some end game here, that we have a new permanent injunction based on the free exercise clause and the establishment clause that the Second Circuit is reviewing right now, that we had oral arguments on November 19th. They're going to issue a ruling. I mean, it's the same three judges who ruled against us 2-1 before. And if they rule against us again, there will probably, an appeal en banc to all of the Second Circuit and then another cert petition. And we'll just see what happens. And the one thing that I would take from the oral argument, it was Judge Calabresi, Judge Walker, and Judge LaValle. And LaValle and Calabresi had been the two that had ruled against us before, is that they took these free exercise arguments quite seriously. It was not, we definitely did not get the attitude of, can't you guys take no for an answer? What are you doing back here? We're irritated. That was definitely not their attitude at the oral arguments. And we'll see what they do and if the U.S. Supreme Court is interested in this case or not.
Yeah, I would just say, this is Alan Brownstein again. The Second Circuit panel, these are very serious jurists. These are not judges who take either free exercise or establishment clause concerns lightly. So I'm not at all surprised that they were paying strict attention to the arguments that are being presented in this case.
Looks like we do have one more question from our audience. Let's go to our final question now.
Hi, I got the impression from the professor's earlier comments that exemptions to, say, your property taxes might be a violation of the Establishment Clause. Is that the intention you meant to give, or what do you think about that?
No, if anything that suggested that tax exemptions for religious institutions violate the Establishment Clause, I certainly didn't intend to communicate that message.
Okay.
So Professor, what would you see, and I haven't read either of these cases in a while, the Waltz case from 1970 that said property tax exemptions are okay versus the Texas Monthly, I think maybe that's where he picked it up. Was it just that the exemption was broader in Waltz to cover all, I think it was nonprofit groups or something like that? Or what is the, do you think, whatever the line was, what was it, and do you think that was the right line for the Supreme Court to draw?
Well, I'll tell you what I think the line is for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, one, to the extent that you're granting religious institutions exemptions as part of a much larger package of exemptions, where religious institutions are doing essentially the same thing, but from a religious perspective, it's perfectly appropriate to extend the same tax status that you extend to a secular institution, to a religious institution. To the extent that the religious institution is doing something different, which essentially would be it's operating a church, and other 501c3 organizations don't do that. They don't do religion. In that sense, they don't conduct worship services. That would be the place where you'd say, well, this is differential treatment of religion. We're providing an accommodation, an exemption for religion that isn't available to other entities, to non-religious entities. And I don't have a problem with that at all from a free exercise perspective. And in this particular case, I don't have a problem with it from an Establishment Clause perspective. I think there's a much bigger problem from a Free Speech Clause perspective. If you're going to conceptualize what churches do as being speakers in the marketplace of ideas, then it becomes harder to explain why they might receive a tax exemption that other arguably similarly situated entities don't receive. It's one of the reasons I'm very wary of the displacement of the religion clauses by the free speech clause.
Well, gentlemen, looks like we're out of audience questions. We have a couple minutes left. Let me offer each of you a chance to wrap up or express any final thoughts if you care to. Why don't we go in reverse order? Professor Brownstein, do you have any final thoughts?
I guess I don't really have anything else to add. I think I took up an unfair amount of time with my initial presentation, so I'm happy to give Jordan whatever time he wants for concluding remarks.
Jordan Lawrence.
Well, it's I think that what was the innovation that was, you know, sort of like necessity is the mother of invention. A year ago when we said the churches are going to get kicked out after February 12th unless we go back in for another injunction, the New York legislature and the city, New York City City Council aren't going to help us. And all of a sudden, we may be on the verge of a new significant doctrinal development on returning or bringing these equal access cases, have them viewed primarily as free exercise cases. And I wish I could say that I had sat down and thought this out as thoroughly as Professor Brownstein had done, but we're going to get something, I think, pretty significant about that from the Second Circuit, and whoever loses is going to appeal that to the Supreme Court. And we may have something of some pretty, you know, significant doctrinal development that will be appealed to the Supreme Court, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Very good. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Jordan Lawrence and Professor Alan Brownstein for joining us today. This has been a very interesting discussion. I want to thank our audience as well for joining us and invite our audience to join us again for our next Teleforum conference call next Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number when we'll be discussing the Supreme Court case being argued that very morning, Bowman versus Monsanto. But until then, We are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.